This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in New York City this week for the start of the 65th United Nations General Assembly. We're going to spend most of this hour focused on what actually gets accomplished here this week and how. But at the last minute, we've gotten the opportunity to spend a few minutes with Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, now author. His new book is titled A Journey, My Political Life. If you have a question for the Prime Minister about his book or the issues it raises, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. He's only got a few minutes, so be quick about it. Prime Minister Blair joins us now from Studio 5 at the UN. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks, Neil.
As the U.S. and the U.K. wind down combat operations in Iraq, I know you argue in your book that the decision to invade was the right decision. Can I ask you to elaborate on that a bit, given the enormous price in blood and treasure?
It's really a question of looking at what happened. We got rid of Saddam after 2 months. We then had a presence there of US, UK and other troops for many years with full United Nations authority by then. And then we faced these forces that wanted to destabilize. And they're the same forces actually we fight everywhere in the region. But the single most important thing, and look, I describe this in my book, obviously in detail, but I think the single most important thing is to recognize what this security threat is and how we now tackle it. Because it's not just related to Iraq. We face the same issues in Afghanistan. We face the same issues in what I've just been dealing with here in the UN, incidentally, which is to do with the Middle East peace process. So the question is, how do we manage to create a world in which there's peaceful coexistence and in which those groups who want to destabilize and cause chaos through terrorism don't succeed?
In retrospect, you're here at the UN. Would it have been better to await UN authority to go in?
It's always better to have UN authority. The issue, however, as I discovered in Kosovo and indeed elsewhere, is what happens if the UN is effectively politically deadlocked. So I think that the question for us was, obviously, we did go to the UN in November 2002 and got the resolution there about Iraq at that time. The question then is, once you actually then had UN authority after the removal of Saddam, as I say, from mid-2003 onwards, we were then facing a quite different type of battle, and that's the battle we still face today, frankly. And those people that would use terrorism and chaos to destabilize countries, that is a phenomenon, unfortunately, not simply related to Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan, or you could go through many other countries. And I think the single most important thing is that the international community unites behind a concept, as I say, of peaceful coexistence.
You mentioned the Middle East peace talks. You represent the quartet as a Mideast envoy. A lot of people wonder how these talks can possibly succeed when the Palestinian Authority speaks for only half the Palestinians.
Well, the Palestinian Authority actually speaks on the peace negotiation for all the Palestinians, but it's correct, as you imply, that you've got Gaza and the West Bank separated. The single best way to bring them back together again, behind a coherent peace process, is for us to make a political negotiation, which we've now begun, for a two-state solution, a secure state of Israel, independent, viable state of Palestine. And then to match that with the measures that I work on, particularly for the Palestinian economy, building the capacity and governance of the Palestinian Authority, so that we, at the same time as we're trying to negotiate a political deal about borders and security in Jerusalem, refugees and so on, we're at the same time then building from the bottom up the institutions, the actual reality, daily reality of life that corresponds to the possibility of statehood. And in that regard, I have no doubt at all that if we manage to push forward towards that two-state solution, people in Gaza will want to be part of it rather than separated out from it.
Yet don't you have to improve their lives in some concrete ways to convince them that this is the right thing to do?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, following the change of policy of a few months ago, we're now getting far more stuff into Gaza, but we need to rehabilitate the infrastructure, rebuild homes there. And at the same time, obviously, is doing everything we can to prevent weapons coming into Gaza, because the enemy of this peace process are those people that, you know, right on the day we launched these peace negotiations, when I was at the White House with President Obama and other leaders there, they go out and they kill people in order to try and destabilize the process. So I think we've got to improve the lives of people in Gaza whilst obviously taking the security measures in order to make sure those people who would use chaos and terrorism to thwart the process are denied that chance.
On Monday, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for a moratorium in Jewish settlements. Can the talks move ahead without something like that or very much like that?
Well, it's a big challenge right now, and we're working hard to find a way through it. I mean, the key thing on settlements is this. If you're going to negotiate a independent, viable Palestinian state, then you obviously don't want anything happening in the meantime that prejudices the outcome of that negotiation. So that's why the issue of settlements are important. And what we want to see is the idea of a reality on the ground developing consistent with the negotiation, not contradicting it. Now, I hope, Neil, in the discussions that will take place over the next few days, that we'll find a way through this, because we do, despite all the negativity around these talks, there is one great thing that we should bear in mind. We have an American president that right from the outset of his term was determined to push the Middle East peace process. We have two leaders that are now committed to the two-state solution. We have two peoples that actually want that solution, and they've shown that consistently. And we have a region that is not just tired of this struggle, but actually recognizes the poison that goes into the whole of the region as a result of it and wants that poison removed. So we have the chance now to create the right environment for that two-state solution, a state of Israel that is secure and recognized by the whole of the region, and a state of Palestine that is independent, sovereign, and viable.
Well, let's get a caller in on the conversation. Ed's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I appreciate all the good work the Prime Minister is doing on behalf of peace. This issue of the two-state solution and settlements is so perplexing. How can 500,000 Israelis live in Palestine with Palestine being a viable state?
Well, that's a good question, Ed. Although, of course, there's you know, very many more than that Israeli Arabs who live in Israel. I think the issue is to decide the borders, and then we can decide what we do about the settlement question. But, you know, this is an issue that has now, you know, dogged us for several years. And I think the key thing we've got to do is to push ahead so that we resolve this notion of what the proper territory for the Palestinian state is. And some of those settlements may remain and they'll be swapped for land that would be given in exchange by Israel. There may be other solutions that we find to this. But if we leave this, the longer we leave it, and I think this is really what your question implies, the more difficult it's going to become. So it's not impossible to have solutions to this, but it's hard to see how we're going to be able to do this if we don't get a solution reasonably soon.
Ed, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
And
finally, Tony Blair, when you were Prime Minister, you attended a lot of these meetings, the general debates here at the United Nations. What did you ever get out of it?
That's a very good question. Look, the thing about these types of summits are, to the outside world, they're just a whole lot of politicians talking. But in the margins of the UN meeting, I've just attended a meeting which is all about boosting the capacity of the Palestinians to build their state, with major pledges of money and so on coming through, peace negotiations going on at the same time. And here's the other thing that happens at these summits, and it's interesting but true to reflect upon. There is the formal process, right? The people you see on TV giving the speeches. And, well, I mean, we can have an interesting debate, I guess, about how much that achieves. But outside, you know, for your average leader, they will be meeting, you know, when I was here as a prime minister, I would maybe have 20 bilaterals with other leaders, where you would be sorting out issues between your countries, issues that maybe were to do with regional problems, and you would actually get a lot done. So sometimes there's more going on in these things than meets the eye. At least I hope so.
At least we hope so. And we hope you get a lot done at this meeting. Good luck with your work.
Thank you very much indeed.
Tony Blair has an urgent meeting to attend, and we thank him for taking the time to speak with us. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair with us from the UN. The book again, A Journey, My Political Life. This September, 192 UN member countries are gathered just down the street, all with their own agendas and their own plans for a week of speeches and meetings, news conferences and dinners. The general debate, as it's called, attracts President Obama, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and dozens of others. But For what? No votes will be recorded, no decisions made. What actually gets done at this highest profile meeting of world leaders? Later in the hour, we'll talk with the former head of relief operations for the UN who coordinated the response in Haiti and Pakistan. But first, with all these leaders in town this week, what should get done? Be specific, please. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Jan Eliasson has been on all sides of the General Assembly, served as its president in 2005, also as Sweden's ambassador to the UN. Now he's in town for the UN meeting as the head of an NGO, the chair of WaterAid Sweden, an international group that focuses on safe water and sanitation in developing countries. He's now taken Tony Blair's chair at Studio 5 in the UN. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here.
And again, the same question that we opened, we closed with Tony Blair. This, some people criticize this as a talking shop. You've presided over it. What actually gets done?
Well, Tony Blair underlined what is very important, that this is a meeting place. Here's where you discuss a lot of serious issues also at the side. But I think the meeting itself reminds us of how much we need to work together on today's global issues. And there has to be a mobilization around the promises that were made. We right now, today, and the next few days before the general debate, we'll discuss if we fulfill the so-called millennium goals on fighting poverty. And these promises were made in the year 2000, and it's a mixed bag in terms of results. And therefore, it's good to have the leaders here and now for me as a representative of civil society to remind them of these promises and to see to it that they are fulfilled and achieved.
Well, we have to take a short break. After it, we'd like to hear listeners' thoughts on specific ideas for what these folks here in New York should get done this week. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from New York City. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in New York City this week for the UN General Assembly. And, of course, world leaders have descended here for the annual meeting to take part in a global conversation. Activists and advocates are here, too, in hopes of drawing attention to their cause. This year, the agenda includes discussions about social development, food security, but among all the pomp, what actually gets done? Today, we're talking about the UN General Assembly, what's accomplished at the annual meetings. We want to hear from you. Tell us what you specifically think 192 world leaders should get done this week. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Jan Eliasson is with us, the former president of the General Assembly from the UN. And you mentioned earlier here working on clean water issues. You're obviously here in New York at this meeting. What are you actually getting done to advance that cause in this week?
Well, I was earlier also special envoy in Darfur for 18 months. I was there, and I came back from that experience absolutely filled with the conviction that we have to move quicker on fulfilling the goals of water and sanitation. Water is improving somewhat, but one of the most neglected areas of development is the lack of sanitation. To put it very simply, toilets. 4,000 kids die every day. And this is the reason why this meeting is so important, is that we have to remind the leaders to do better on this. In some areas, there are progress, like child mortality and mm-hmm. also literacy. So there are some areas where there are improvement. But this is to check where we are on the different issues and remind them to move faster, particularly, I would say, on sanitation.
And how do you do that? Do you hold meetings with these leaders? Are you going to meet with President Obama? Are you going to meet with the president of Sudan?
Well, we are going to listen to them now and hope to see to hear commitments to do better on both development assistance, on trade and other issues that relate to development. And also from the developing countries who have the problems that they give higher priority to dealing with issues related to sanitation and health. The beauty of doing this better on sanitation is that it has tremendously positive effects also on child mortality, maternal health, extreme poverty, gender equality. These goals hang together.
And we know the value of the cause, so do you, but how do you communicate that to the people who actually make decisions?
Well, when a leader, I was also foreign minister of Sweden. When
yes,
you go
are.
To a meeting like this, you have to sort of say, what do I have to bring? And what can I say about our development systems? Shall we stick to the 0% percentage of aid of the GMP? Shall we do more vis-a-vis this sector and other sectors? So the meeting itself is a place where you have to stand up to the promises made in the year 2000. If we just made those promises 10 years ago and forgot about them, then we would probably have a very, very lacking achievement of the goals. Here is now a pretty stern discussion. We have not only members of government and the international organizations, we have also civil society. And the tone of these discussions is very open and very frank. We have interactive discussions, and we are hearing that they are improving the rate of success on certain sectors. So it's moving ahead in some areas, it's going backwards in others.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255, email us talk@npr.org. What should the world leaders get done this week here in New York? We'll go to Scott. Scott with us from Greenville, South Carolina.
Gentlemen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
The topic I would propose would be piracy internationally around the world. It's expensive, lives are risked, and it destabilizes the governments in areas where it takes place, especially Somalia.
And it's an important issue. Jan Eliasson, would you expect that anything could get accomplished at a meeting like the UN general debate on such an issue?
This piracy situation is an example of how difficult it is to divorce ourselves from what goes on in the rest of the world. Somalia is called a so-called failed state. But in this failed state, so-called failed state, is the best organized piracy operation in the world, which affects the shipping and insurance rates. This is a problem that has to be dealt with both by law and order actions, and you have Navy units from all over the world practically to deal with this. But I also want to point at something that I heard from my friends from Africa, and that is that there's been tremendous amount of fishing in that area, so that in the villages there's no economic basis to carry on fishing. And young people are taking to this illegal action, of course. And then secondly, there were also lots of chemical waste thrown at the borders, at the beaches of Somalia, when this complete disruption took place during the civil war. So this matter comes up indirectly. It's a failed state, but it's also a proof that we have to realize that we are together in this world.
One of the difficulties in pursuing piracy has been the lack of a agreed legal system to attack it. Is the United Nations an appropriate institution to say we need to revise our laws on piracy, international crime?
I think so. This is a typical example of today's problems that is not fully dealt with. And I think there are discussions going on. How we should deal with the piracy operations. I'm not really informed about the details, but it's going on.
All right, Scott, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go next to, this is Troy. Troy with us from Iowa City.
Yes, I would like them to address the fraud that is being done with billions of dollars that the UN has just unfortunately can't account for. And why should the United States citizen pay the UN money when the UN ambassadors can't even pay their parking tickets to New York?
Fraud is we've had the example of the UN food for fuel program in Iraq that was found to be, and I think other people complain about the amount of bureaucracy at the United Nations. And Ambassador Eliasson, do you think that this is something that can be dealt with at this meeting? It's something that the United States, still the largest donor to the United Nations, the citizenry complains about a great deal.
Well, I understand this concern, and of course the organization is definitely not perfect. I have served this organization also myself and have seen the bureaucracy. But I think if you look at the larger perspective, there is so much of value that is done by this organization. I was responsible for emergency operations all over the world back in the 90s, and I can tell you that people are working day and night and to the sacrifice of their lives to help people who are struck by civil wars or by natural disasters. And I think it's important that also one of the greatest countries of the world realizes that it is important to find ways of cooperate together with other nations. Going it alone is not the right way to go. And we will have difficulty working up a good cooperation among all nations, but it's the only one we have. And the United Nations is not the organization that reflects the world that we would like to see. It's a reflection of the world as it is. But I'm glad to see the new signs of interest from the American administration to deal with the United Nations as a partner.
And when you've been here in New York, based in New York at various times, did you pay your parking tickets?
I did. Sweden always paid their tickets, and we rarely had parking tickets. So I think this, at least from my perspective, is an exaggerated issue. We should try to see the positive values of having the World Organization in the United States to show that there has to be cooperation among even the greatest and most powerful nations and the rest of the world, the 191 other countries. Shakespeare said once that there's a world outside Verona. And I think we all have to realize that there is a world outside Verona. And in today's world, you can't simply take that away. It's a fact of life, whether we like it or not.
Stuart's on the line from Baltimore.
Yes, good afternoon. Great program, gentlemen. Do you think the United Nations could do a better job in communicating the fine work that it really does and communicate it in a way that the general public will really appreciate? The enormous amount of money that is spent, but obviously the great work that is accomplished.
I was thinking of that when I was in the camps of Darfur. You know, 2 million people sitting in camps, population of 6 million. And I saw my colleagues from the UN working day and night. And some of them were American. And I said to them, why don't you go home and tell the story? It seems like they didn't want to brag. But there is so much going out there. While we are talking, kids are being vaccinated. Medicine is being distributed. Wells are being drilled. Lots of things are being done which are not known. So I really appreciate your question. It comes as a great relief to hear that type of question. And I wish we could see more of that. But we'd certainly have to improve this organization. I'm the first one to say that. I was negotiating reforms, and it was a very heavy exercise.
Stuart,
what keep up the good work, please.
I just wanted to ask you, Stuart, when you bring up this point at parties or at dinner with other people in Baltimore, how do they respond?
I think there's a serious lack of awareness of the depth and breadth of what is being done, and often politics cloud visions of really the work that's done. I think the UN could do a much better job in connecting with grassroots support across the world, actually. Anyway, that would be my plea.
Okay.
I would say that this is very interesting, and I would say something that might sound paradoxical. Maybe we have too high expectations on the UN. We point at the UN up there in the air and expect the UN to solve all problems. But that is not going to be the case. We need in this world to have a sense of international division of labor. Governments have a responsibility. The academic world has a responsibility. The NGO community has a responsibility. Nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. These global problems are so huge that we simply have to take our part of the problem. And in that discussion, UN has one part, but all of us have other parts.
And of course, in communicating that message, the UN would have to be careful not to be seen to be propagandizing anybody. So
exactly,
that's the other side of the line. Stuart, thanks very much for the call.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Email from Joni in St. Louis. I truly believe the main and first topic that needs to be addressed is the speed with which global warming is affecting each one of the nations that are gathered. Please have them tell me their country is doing great and that there's no future danger for their citizens. I do dare them. What are the promises that have been made, and what difference does it all make if we can't survive in our climate? So the environment, you're dealing with it specifically on the issue of clean water, but that is affected by changing climates as well.
Yeah. I met the president of the Maldives some time ago. His island will be disappearing from the map in about 100 years. He's already making plans to move his population. We will have enormous movement of people from the rise of the sea level. In Darfur, I saw also the desert win over the farmland all over the place. So this is a huge problem, which seems to be far away, but in reality is creeping up on us right now. So there is a direct connection between dealing with these short-term issues and the change of climate. And this is also going to be one of the main reasons for conflicts in the future, when you have millions of people moving into areas, into countries that already are overpopulated. You have conflicts coming. So there is also the importance of enlightened, seeing the enlightened self-interest. When we in the rich world are asked to make sacrifices, as it seems, it's actually an investment in the future for our kids and for the planet. If we don't do this, we pay a much heavier price later on.
Jan Eliasson, former Foreign Minister of Sweden and former President of the General Assembly. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now from the UN is the current President of the General Assembly, the 65th General Assembly, Ambassador Josef Deiss of Switzerland. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Very happy to be with you. Thank you.
And when you look ahead to the week, how will you measure success?
Well, we have first is Millennium Development Goals high-level summit, and there we already have two parts of the answers. We need the third. The two parts is, I said, we must. I think everybody is convinced that we have to do something. The second is that we can. We know that we have the potential to alleviate or even to eradicate poverty. And the third, that will be the outcome, or should be the outcome, of that summit, that all the heads of states, all the member states say, and we will, we want to do it. That is the momentum I hope we are actually creating here in New York during these 3 days. I'm very happy about the first statements made by several member states. And they have been very important messages. For example, the one who said, we are not saying that we are continue to pledge the same amounts. We are not going, in spite of the crisis, to do less. We are going to do more. And that's the message I want to hear from everybody here in New York.
Can you give us some idea? Is the president of the General Assembly, is this largely a ceremonial role? What do you actually do?
Well, the General Assembly itself has no concrete decisional power. We need to reach consensus. That means we can become efficient if all the members are in line on the same goal. And that's also the case for the president. He has no power to take important decisions. What he has to be is what we call here a facilitator. When we have a problem, we name some people to try to find solutions. So I would say the president of the General Assembly has to be the super facilitator and to find the ways, bring people, countries together. And in so you, at the same time, you have not much power, but you have a lot of liberty if you are prepared to take these opportunities, to go to the people, to be the networker. And that's what the president should do.
Jan Eliasson, and we just have a few seconds left. I wonder if you could point to us an example from your time as President of the General Assembly where you got something done.
The year I was president was 2005 and 2006. We created a peace-building commission which deals with the post-conflict situation so that countries don't land into conflicts immediately afterwards. We created an anti-terrorism program, which is very concrete and which works. We established a central emergency fund for situations like the one in Pakistan and Burma. We also took the decision on the Human Rights Council, which was a controversial one, but the organizations now exist. So it was a very productive year, and the General Assembly was indeed the legislative body of the United Nations that it should be. I would hope that the General Assembly would play a more important role, because we represent 192 nations, and most of the attention to the UN is mostly directed to the Security Council, mm-hmm. with only 15 members.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both very much for your time today. And Josef Deiss, we wish you the best of luck in your year as President of the General Assembly.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed.
Switzerland's permanent representative to the United Nations, Josef Deiss, now president of the 65th General Assembly. Jan Eliasson, thank you also for your time today, and good luck on the clean water issue.
Good to be with you, Neil.
Coming up, the challenges of responding to global disasters such as those in Haiti, Darfur, and Pakistan. Sir John Holmes, a former Undersecretary General, Emergency Relief Coordinator for the UN. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.